This is the SF Productions Podcast Network. How I Got My Wife to Read Comics, Episode 133. This episode was previously recorded. Can a comic collector of 20 plus years get his wife to read them? Will she let him keep them? Learn more in this podcast. Let's go to the comic book lounge with Mindy and Mark.
Well, thank you, AnnouncerBot, and welcome to How I Got My Wife to Read Comics. I'm Mark.
And I'm Mindy. Just as a reminder, we have a Facebook fan page. Just go to Facebook and search for How I Got My Wife to Read Comics. You can go to sfpodcastnetwork.com for the feed, other SF podcasts, and blogs, or go to iTunes and search for How I Got My Wife to Read Comics, where you can leave us a review.
And you can contact us through the website, Facebook, or email, sfpodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Finally, you can call the voice line at 614-321-9737. That's 614-321-9SFP.
Now, Mark, we're recording this episode, and it may not air the week it's recorded.
Right.
Because this is one for the stockpile for holidays.
Exactly.
So
happy holidays.
Exactly. Well, it's always going to be some sort of holiday coming
somewhere.
Up.
Somewhere.
Okay.
And we're talking today about the gimmick age of comics. You know, we've talked about the various golden age and silver age and bronze age. Well, in there really was a gimmick age. And it started with some changes in the comic book industry in the early 80s, where newsstands gave way to comic book shops. When I was a kid, I could go to the drugstore, and that's in fact where I went to get my comics. And today, you can still find a few drugstores that carry them, but it's a very limited supply. You pretty much go into a comic book shop.
Well, just as an aside, I noticed when we were at Borders the other day that they had quite a big rack of comics.
They did, but still not as many as you'd get at a shop.
No, but maybe what you would have seen at a newsstand
when you were
a kid.
So we also saw creators' rights greatly change, where it went from piecework, you know, you got paid per page, to the point where you actually owned or had some sort of rights to the characters you created. And then finally, you saw, as kind of a side effect of that, is independent comics really exploding, became huge. It's in the 80s. Everybody was cranking out comics. As a result, the bigger companies, the big guys, which were at that point DC and Marvel, were hurting. I mean, there was so much competition that suddenly it was a very different market for them. And then in 1986, Marvel Comics got sold to New World Pictures. Marvel got sold over and over and over in the 80s and 90s. And, of course, just recently got sold to Disney. The new owners wanted more sales, and they wanted them now. And they looked at what was happening over at DC in 1986, which was just completing the Crisis on Infinite Earths. So the big solution was the crossover. And that's a gimmick that really continues to this day.
I have to say, because when I first started reading comics with you, it seemed like there were a lot more crossovers. And you actually had to buy every single comic to get the story. But a lot of them now, you know, like with the Black Lanterns and... Mm-hmm. Whatever they're calling that series, you didn't necessarily have to buy every one, although to get the whole story.
They've realized that the readers just aren't going to put up with the idea that they have to buy everything anymore.
Right.
And that's been a losing proposition. So they've said, okay, we'll write it in this more open way. But crossovers have, instead of becoming several crossovers going on, we now see much larger single crossovers than you used to see. So we move on to the 1990s, and this is when we saw rampant speculation in the comic book industry. Because of all the independent comics, because of all the new interest in comic book movies, that there was a big point in the 90s, really the 80s going into the 90s, where people were buying them because they were convinced they were going to put their kids through college on this, which the logic never made any sense. I mean, from day one of the comic book industry, this is not something you do just for investment purposes.
Well, if you think about it, the reason that some of the older comics are so valuable is because they're rare. People didn't save those newsstand comics.
Exactly.
They threw them away or their moms threw them away.
Mm-hmm.
But what you have now and in the 90s was people who are collecting them, who are bagging and boarding them and sticking them away.
Right.
As a hoarder.
Right.
And so there's so many of them.
Right.
That unless there's some sort of a huge catastrophe, there's no rarity involved.
Right. Essentially, going back almost to like the mid-60s, there's a point there where the first comic book conventions got started. The value of comics after that point went way down in terms of value. Stuff before that is really the most valuable stuff. But overall, you could do far better even today in the stock market. You could do better today in real estate, even with the current situation, than you're ever going to do just buying comic books in order to make money off of them.
Now, that's not to say that there are single individual issues
Absolutely.
That don't appreciate a little bit.
Absolutely.
You know, a cover price of $2 might go to $4.
Right, but overall.
But it's going to balance out that your
right.
collection is about worth what you paid for it.
Right, if you're lucky. And so, as you were saying, everybody's saving them. There's huge runs of specific issues, especially major event issues, these gimmick issues. And the result is the price drops very quickly. So during this period of wild speculation, we moved into what I call stupid cover gimmicks.
You call them that now.
Yes. Well, I thought they were stupid then, too. I bought them, but they were stupid. So we start with 3D comics. Now, these really go back to the 1950s and the 3D craze back then. A man by the name of Ray Zone, which I assume is not his real name, created hundreds of these 3D titles, and he still does those. He was the guy responsible for the Superman Reborn 3D Final Crisis, whatever it was called. He was responsible for that. And we went from both the traditional red-blue type 3D with the glasses. And then we also did what they call the lenticular titles. And we saw ones where it was just part of the cover. And the idea of lenticular is like the old – we used to get real toys in Cracker Jack where if you move the thing back and forth, you'd see a character move back and forth. And because it was like a ridged plastic with different artwork on it. But we went from little parts of the cover – where, and I think one of the first ones that did something like that, there were Robin miniseries. There was a Robin 2 miniseries and a Robin 3 miniseries, and they put these lenticular parts of the cover. There were full lenticular covers. I remember a Superman issue where they did this. Of course, it makes it a really ungainly comic because it's a big hunk of plastic for the cover.
And then how do you bag and board it?
Right. So we then see the glow-in-the-dark covers. Well, that's something that, you know, glow-in-the-dark is pretty easy to do. It's just a matter of putting the right chemicals in the ink.
Yes.
And so you saw a lot of the glow-in-the-dark covers.
I have a question about that, though.
Yeah.
Is that something that's going to fade over time?
Presumably.
In any case? And it doesn't really add to the ongoing value
no.
of your comic?
No.
Because
no.
it's probably not going to glow-in-the-dark 15 years from
exactly.
when you bought it.
Yeah. It's a gimmick. And then we saw the embossed covers where they actually press onto the cover itself so that it raises in a certain area. And you did that with logos and things like that. And embossing by itself wasn't enough. So you did embossed silver and embossed gold. And then you had chromium, which meant nothing.
Except it sounded
except
good.
It sounded good. Chromium cover. You had die cut covers where they actually cut a shape into the front cover. There was one issue of a Marvel comic, I don't know if it was Marvel or Image, where they actually had a bullet hole that went through the entire comic. All the pages through the back.
And it went into the story through there,
yeah.
each page?
Yeah, apparently. We had gatefold covers, which is the idea of taking multiple versions of a cover or multiple issues and putting them together and they form one picture.
Oh, okay. That's not...
I
would have thought gatefold was where you folded it out and you
well,
had
there,
a bigger
there,
picture.
But there were those as well. And there were also
okay.
wraparounds, which is kind of the same thing, which is taking a single... Within a single issue, you can wrap around both the front and the back covers or even a fold-out.
Okay.
You had... there were at least two cases of this. Well, they never actually called it this because it's a copyrighted name, but they were color form covers.
Yes, you've recently gotten in the last year or so gotten out one of those for me to play with. So
right. There was,
it was a Superman.
Yeah, it was a Superman issue. It was actually Man of Steel 75. I looked it up. That is a otherwise blank cover with like a skyline of Metropolis on it with the Daily Planet on the top of the building in the foreground. And then you got this whole page of little pictures of Superman and Lobo. And then you could use the little color forms and make your own battles on the front of the page, front of the cover. We had holograms, kind of another version of 3D. You saw a lot of that as well. One of the goofiest ones I thought they ever did was there was an Eclipso crossover event. Early 90s, I'm guessing. Mid 90s, I don't remember offhand. Where the first issue included a cover that had a plastic gem attached that had thickness. Now, that's not good for long boxes and collecting because
no.
whatever the issue is in front of it is going to have that embossed into it too, whether you like it or not.
So how'd you deal with that?
I think it was something in front of it I didn't really care about. So.
Oh.
But, I mean, what else are you going to do?
Well, you could put it in a separate
away,
box
I suppose.
Or pull the gem off. Or...
Oh, pull the gem off.
I remember that was like one of those summer crossover
yeah, it was.
Ones,
yeah, they,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
They used to do a big summer event. Now
exactly.
It's like the events last all year.
Right, yeah. It used to be pretty much in the summer, but now.
And a lot of times it was just those summer events were the annuals, right?
Right. Yeah, so. That for the longest time, that's how DC did it.
Yeah.
And they really almost, in many cases, pulled it out completely separate from the other continuity.
Which actually makes a lot of
yes.
sense. I think
yeah.
that's a better thing
yeah.
to do, but.
Yeah. And then we had the variant covers, and many of these are based on the number of copies a dealer purchases. So you get, as a dealer, you'll get a variant cover if you buy at least 50 copies or 75 copies or something like that.
This still goes on quite a
oh,
bit
yeah.
now.
Oh, yeah. If you want them, you can order them. DC does it all the time. I mean, and there's probably half a dozen alternate covers a month that come out today. You don't see very many of them because... It's like,
well,
okay, why, you know, why do I want to do
you know
with...
where you do see them, though, is when they collect them into graphic novels.
Right.
And then they put them all in the back of the graphic novel.
Yeah.
I noticed this with Irredeemable and
mm-hmm.
And the companion to Irredeemable, which was Incorruptible.
Yeah. Well, companies like Boom and IDW, that's their bread and butter is the variant cover. I don't think IDW has ever put out an issue that didn't have a variant cover. That's just what they do. Dynamite
mm-hmm.
does this hugely. Boom does it a lot. The smaller guys do it a lot because, you know, it's another way to make extra sales. It's a gimmick. Then we have the stunts. And there are two major stunts I wanted to talk about. One of which is Death in the Family. Now, this was in the mid-80s where they had introduced Jason Todd as the second Robin.
And yeah, this was way before I was reading
right.
comics.
Right. Actually, I think I was actually reading them at the time. I seem to remember, but I wasn't actually collecting that one.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people didn't really like the character of the second Robin, as happens in when you try to replace a character with somebody new. People don't like it. And so they were mad that Dick Grayson was kind of being pushed to the side, although he had been Nightwing for a long time by that point. And so they came up with a great idea, and this was back in the era of the 900 number, where they said...
Before texting.
Before
Ooh.
Texting. This is way before texting. And said, if you call this number, that's a vote toward killing Jason Todd in the comic, and if you call this number, we won't kill him. And in the end, there were about 10,000 votes, and by only 64 votes... character was killed. And this was in Batman number 429. There are many suggestions or theories that this was all rigged. It would have been very easy. In fact, somebody at DC later said that they believe that a hacker had and this is very easy, because especially with only 64 votes, to do one of those auto-dialer things.
But with the 900 number, that would cost you.
It would cost you every time. It was a buck every time.
But on the other hand, if DC really wanted to kill the character off, all they would have to do is have like five interns calling
right.
the
yeah.
number for
yeah.
how long.
How hard it would have been. Yeah. Yeah. So, and of course, only recently has Jason Todd come back because, of course, all characters come back. And one of the best examples of this, the example of this, is the death of Superman.
Now, I really think that it was just lame to even imagine that Superman wouldn't come back from this.
But DC, to the general public and to the general press, they pushed that point. No, he's dead.
Yes.
You know, it was, and with no hint that he was coming back. Now, did the fans knew? Well, duh, of course he's coming back. but what's interesting, I think, about this is the death of Superman occurred because of synergy. It occurred because of the Lois and Clark, the New Adventures of Superman series, TV series. And they decided, oh, in the TV series, Lois and Clark are getting married. So we're going to have Lois and Clark get married in the comic book. Finally, Lois and Clark get married. Right. And then the writers and producers of the TV show decided they were going to string this out for like a year, which they did. And so DC suddenly was told, well, you got to wait a year to do that. Well, they were building the whole storyline toward that. And now they're like, oh, sorry, you got to hold for a year. And so what do you do to fill a gap in your storyline? And Jerry Ordway, in a writer's session, was quoted as saying, let's just kill him. and it was a joke. And, oh, yeah, we'll kill him. But they realized you could do that. And it got enormous media attention, but a huge event. DC shipped between 2.5 and 3 million copies of Superman number 75, which is, by the way, the cover art for this episode. And you had the regular edition, and then you had the special Memorial Collector's Edition. And this is probably the best example of a gimmick comic. You had, it was included in a black poly bag, so it was already pre-bagged for you.
And it had the comic.
And okay. It had the comic, yes. Well, yeah, it did have the comic. It also had a trading card, it had a poster, it had stamps, it had the official Daily Planet obituary for Superman, and a black armband. Now, the week that came out, I remember this, where I came in, and because I had a pull account, which is for those who don't collect comics directly today, you go and you set up a pull account with your comic book dealer, and that you tell him this is what I want, and he'll pull them before you show up.
And before the general public
gets a chance to see it.
Gets a chance to pull it off the shelf.
So I came in and bought my Superman 75, and I did, in fact, buy both the Memorial and the regular edition. In fact, I believe I bought two copies of the Memorial edition, and one of which I could open and one of which I could stay sealed.
Yes, but darn it, we should have sold it.
Yes, that week. Because other people, the same week that I bought it at cover price.
Well, and I think you even got a slight discount off the cover price.
No, I did, yeah, because I was a regular customer. So at shows that weekend, comic book shows, people were buying copies at $75 or more that had come out that week and were available at cover price if you could find one.
And yet, and I remember I was working in an office at that point in time, and one of my coworkers came in and said to me, well, and said to the office at large, I got three copies of that Superman comic. I only paid like $50 each for them. I'm going to put my kid through college on this. Yeah. I wanted to tell him, no, you're not.
It's called supply and demand. It doesn't work that way.
Oh.
So it was never worth more than the cover. In fact, I'm sure it's not even worth cover price today.
Well, and I was at our comic book store about a month ago, probably. Our comic book store, which is Pack Rat Comics, which we really love.
Yes.
And Jamie was on the phone with somebody who had called in to ask how much he could get for that Superman comic now. And I think Jamie said, you know, maybe $5 if it's in, you know, excellent condition.
Yes. So, of course, he came back. Superman came back as a character. They used this as a way to introduce a whole set of new characters. The current Superboy, Connor Kent, was introduced here. Steel, the Eradicator, the Cyborg Superman. And then a nice postscript to all this is when they finally came out with Superman the Wedding Album. So why they did all this? It's worth almost nothing today because it had come out just shortly after the wedding issue for Peter Parker and Mary Jane Parker. Well, what became Mary Jane Parker in Spider-Man, which sold enormously. And so DC said, we're going to make a huge run of this thing. Most comic book dealers you could probably drop by and they will have a stack of these issues because they never sold. They, you know, it never sold anywhere near. It's worth nothing. But this also started the whole death and resurrection concept for comic books. I mean, really kickstarted it throughout the industry, which ends up being, of course, the basis for Blackest Night. The idea that there are all these characters that came back and shouldn't have.
Yes.
But it also finally broke the whole bubble of speculation because quickly after that, people went, oh, so these things aren't going to be worth a fortune.
Yeah,
oh.
I'm not going to get $1 million for this. Oh.
We continue to see gimmicks. We'll continue to see gimmicks. It's just a way of the industry.
Well, I guess so. I just wish that sometimes the gimmicks wouldn't replace a good story and good artwork.
Right. That I think that's what we really want. That'd be the best gimmick of all. So, want to remind you about the Facebook fan page. Search for How I Got My Wife to Read Comics. Go to sfpodcastnetwork.com for the feed, other SF podcasts and blogs. Or you can go to iTunes and search for How I Got My Wife to Read Comics. And please leave us a review.
You can contact us through the website, Facebook, or email sfpodcastnetwork@gmail.com. And in fact, if you'd like us to talk about any aspect of DC or comics history in any episode, you could email us and ask us about it, and we might do that.
Exactly.
And you can call our voice line at 614-321-9737. That's 614-321-9SFP. And perhaps tell us about a gimmick comic that you bought and later regretted.
Right.
Or didn't regret.
Yeah. And we'll see you next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.